The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and joining me as our special guest this week is Neil Jones, Senior Digital Marketing Manager at Sky Betting and Gaming. Hi Neil, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, all good, thank you. And also joining me, the ever entertaining and ever reliable CEO of ExchangeWire, Kieran O'Kane. How are you, Kieran?
Great. So you are a proper politician. I was late as well. Like, I'm good at this. I have to say, it's a pleasure to be on this podcast today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure having you, even if a couple of minutes late.
I know.
Our first story of this week, if we'll just dive right in, is that the UK government have introduced the draft version of the online safety bill. They introduced it last month. They originally announced the bill in 2019 and revealed details of it at the end of 2020. The bill seeks to limit the spread of disinformation and harmful content on digital platforms and will be governed by Ofcom. The body will have the power to fine companies either £18 million or 10% of their annual turnover, whichever is higher, to punish them for non-compliance with the bill. And they'll also have the power to block access to their platforms. Campaigners have responded with some complaint to the fact that the bill doesn't levy any criminal liability against senior executives of these platforms if they fail to comply, as well as the fact that the bill doesn't cover fraud or any sort of scams that are run on social platforms like Facebook or Twitter or Google. However, the Culture Secretary has defended the bill and said that companies are more fearful of fines than they are of prosecution, and prosecution will be reserved for cases of severe non-compliance. So I suppose my first question about this story, and I'll come to you first, Neil, is do you think that the bill in its current form will actually help police social media platforms better? Will it actually do enough to prevent the spread of misinformation? Or do you think that inevitably there'll need to be stronger measures attached to it, such as criminal liability?
Yeah, I think when I first read this and had a read through, I'd read it at the same time as when I was looking at the Facebook annual rev figures for 2020, which were 86 billion, I think, which were up for like from like 70. And when I look at that whole, because I think it's 18 million or 10% of turnover, right? I think that's the kind of balance. But I think the main thing is, first off, it feels like progress. I think anything like this, it feels like it's a step in the right direction. Part of me was kind of like, have they done the whole kind of consultation with people who know social media companies and people who know tech platforms, as well as people who obviously have like specialisms in mental health and all that kind of stuff. But I think if you really want them to sit up and take notice, it needs to be one of those where you kind of hit them in the pockets. So I certainly think that the kind of like the fine is definitely the route to take, I would say.
Kieran, what do you think?
Is it enough? 10% of revenue? Is it total revenue or is it UK revenue? Or is it, what is it?
It's 10% of annual turnover, or 18 million, whichever one's higher.
Right, okay. I mean, it's just a speed bump for some of these guys, isn't it? Like, you know, they are responsible for some of the worst events ever to happen in the last decade, like Brexit and the Trump election. Like, so, you know, you could argue that disinformation was probably helped the UK to leave the EU. I'm not going to get controversial here. I think it's the stupidest decision made by anybody ever. And you could argue that Facebook was responsible for the rise of Trump, and it's still responsible for a lot of the anti-Biden and the falsehoods around his legitimate presidency. I mean, these guys don't seem to be learning from these lessons, and these fines just seem like kind of small and petty, like, you know what I mean? It's a speeding fine, effectively. I think, like, I would have preferred to see people go to jail. I would have liked to see the cops turn up, but you know, Nick Clegg, who's an absolute bell end in my view, continues to be
at his house,
and get him into the car and take him to prison. You know, I want to see him go to jail. Like, he goes and talks, basically protects Facebook on a day-to-day basis. And these are like Facebook in particular and Twitter, I think, are these platforms are responsible for some heinous crimes. And they have never like taken responsibility for it. They always kind of like hide behind free speech. But the reality is their algorithms have kind of like optimized towards hate and negative feelings to kind of help sell more ads. And I think it just feels the government is still out of step with this stuff. It just doesn't feel strong enough for me. Like, because there's other like problems on the horizon. Like we got like, you know, we've got a massive anti-vaxxer movement in Europe and in the States, and to a certain extent here. Like we don't want that, you know, being exacerbated by these platforms who seem to be kind of ignoring the good of humanity for, you know, and focusing on their own bottom line profit. So I didn't think this has gone far enough. I mean, I personally think that breaking up Facebook is the way to go. Arrest all the top executives and close it down. That would be my, but nobody's listening to me.
I mean, we are. I don't know how much we can do for you there. But. I mean, so with that in mind, do you think the fact that criminal liability is sort of reserved as a special measure points to the amount of influence that Facebook has? I mean, I read another article that, you know, social media execs had sort of complained that if criminal charges were added to some sort of regulation, it would just make the UK a less popular destination for these companies to operate in.
Great. let's see them leave. That's more money for the rest of us. How is this a bad thing? I think that, look, it's a fair point to make. Like, where do you draw the line in criminal liability around this stuff? But it just feels that these like I would have preferred 50% or 60% of the revenue. That's more of a bit of a red light for a CFO. That would motivate shareholders to be angry around the policies of these platforms. So I think personally, it's like I think you it would have been sort of a mix for me, really. Some kind of liability, maybe not to the point of like criminal liability, but some kind of liability.
So I suppose, I mean, this story raises the question of where liability should lie, or I mean, who should be responsible for policing content. I mean, as you mentioned, Mark Zuckerberg and other sort of top CEOs, and you know, they cry foul about, you know, how measures such as these sort of impose free speech. But is it just inevitable that it will have to be these platforms that, you know, take the rap for content from users? Neil, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I definitely think there has to be a shared ownership. I definitely think that obviously they've like the way I look at it, and I kind of always kind of hark it back to some of the like the when I was like much earlier in my career, like some of the platforms would come in, like you meet with TikTok and stuff like that, and the main question that's in your mind is this platform safe enough for me to put my clients' ads on that platform, and do they have the guardrails in place? And you kind of always get that feeling that. And this is just naturally the case because this is just how you scale an app, right? Or scale a business. You scale the ad part of the business before you scale the brand safety, algorithmic safety part of the business first. Because that's just the nature of business. Like, it's how you get past the Series A and B and all that kind of stuff. But I definitely think that when you look at like some of the stats, I'm trying to remember back like to one of the, I think it was the Office of National Statistics that said, I think it's 91% of people now who are aged 16 to 24 who engage in social media. And I think out of that age group, we've seen a 70% increase in anxiety and depression over the last 25 years. And I think although social media can be massively blamed for that, you've also got things like the advent of the internet, messaging apps, the smartphone. There's a lot that kind of like goes in hand with it. But obviously social media is just a massive megaphone, isn't it, for the things that make us pretty bad as like a human race in a way. Like it's quite strange. Like you may remember the story years ago, which The Verge put out, which they did an investigation into the people who moderate the content on Facebook's platform. Don't know whether you remember any of the stories that came out around that, but they were expected to do like one ticket per minute, which I think, you know, looking at like an 8-hour day, it's like 500 tickets of things that are like far right content, things that are really going to impact those people who are working in that division's mental health. But even when I remember reading the article, they'd said like, was part of it where they'd flagged, hey, I'm feeling really bad, like from a mental health standpoint, I'm not really in a great place after seeing a lot of this content. And even kind of their own people who were working for the company, they weren't really massively looking after. And that was a massive shame. I remember kind of reading that and thinking, yeah, that's not really right. So not only are we talking about user protection, even the people, when we look at the employees who are vetting some of this stuff, because your algorithm isn't advanced enough to actually handle it and take it down automatically. It just flags it, and then you need a human to kind of come in, kind of assess it, and then see what's what. So, you know, I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, like I definitely think that the responsibility predominantly has to lie with the platform. I do have a really random idea about like an independent third party organization that would almost be like, I feel like there's an opening in the market for a company that could almost take money from all those platforms. They have a very strong
algorithm. Yes, like a what do you call it, like or you know, a moat type thing where they look at content and flag it.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, we pay Facebook pays them, Snapchat pays them, TikTok all of them pay this subscription for this company that is like almost kind of like a forum moderator in a way. I don't know whether I'm just like, it's wishful thinking there, but I kind of just thought that might be a nice solution. But yeah,
I mean, considering, you know, you look at Twitter's efforts to sort of moderate their, or you know, review content on their platform, and you know, that hasn't gone particularly well, and they've tried to sort of make it a balance of in-house and user-based, it could well be that, you know, we do need a third party that's actually dedicated to doing it and doing it properly, and that will actually be the solution, really.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you turn off the hate and you turn off the anger on Twitter and Facebook, they're not really going to be the type of revenue machines that they would be if people are sensible. Like, Twitter is just a shout match, effectively. And I would say a good portion of their accounts are fake. I would say, like, if Twitter blue ticked all of their accounts that were actually real people and you had to verify it, their business would collapse. It's just full of bots. And that's the other problem. The business models don't work towards the good of humanity. And I think you need to go hard on this. I think the government's too soft and they need to go a little bit harder. You know, if you want to really affect some change in these platforms, you want to go like full on, like increase the fines and make somebody liable for the content.
So essentially the UK government's just
chickened out. Yeah. Chris, chickened out as usual. What do you expect from Boris Johnson and his crowd of cronies? Like,
well, as I'm sure we could have a huge and potentially very controversial discussion about that, but we'll leave it for now and move on to our second story. So despite general consensus that the market is oversaturated, podcasts are a significant business opportunity now more than ever, according to Alex Kantrowitz from Big Technology. He says that this is evidenced by the fact that Facebook, Apple, Spotify and Twitter are all sort of working on their own podcast offering or enhancing their own podcast offerings. Adoption is still slow in the US. Only 107 million of the 33 odd million population actually listen to podcasts, and only for about 6 out of 100 minutes. Whereas terrestrial still leads, reaching 91% of US adults who listen to it for about 42 minutes out of 100. And ad spend on terrestrial radio was around $10 billion last year, whereas ad spend on podcasts was less than $1 billion. However, Alex is confident that this can change, particularly due to the fact that technology has improved to make listening to podcasts and creating podcasts easier. Citing statistics from eMarketer, Alex goes on to say that ad spend could increase by more than 30% year on year, so rising to $1.33 billion. In 2021 and $1.74 billion in 2022. And interestingly, subscription models are growing, which means that it's a lot easier for more creators to come to the scene and get their podcasts off the ground because they don't have to rely on advertising revenue quite so much as they used to. So do you agree that podcasting has this sort of potential that hasn't quite been realised yet? And are you convinced that audio technology and its improvements there will lead to higher listening numbers? Kieran, I'll come to you first this time.
I actually met Alex a couple of times. Fierce, nice lad. I had a couple of pints with him in New York a few years ago. Actually met in this small bar, which is run by this ex-boxer. And me and Alex got pretty drunk there. But he's a nice chap. Done very well for himself. I think he's got a point. I think I still think there's an untapped channel. I think the biggest problem for me, like personally, because I'm a big podcast listener, right, is that it's discovery piece, right? How do you discover? and schedule these podcast episodes, because like it's very much like, you know, you get recommended and you listen to it, but I think there's a discovery element that still hasn't been properly realized, and I think that's one very important tool that's missing right at the minute. And it's, I suppose that applies as well to discovery across all of the different streaming options in the TV and CTV world. But in terms of audio, I think like also, you know, the technology as well around programmatic is making it easier to do like scale buys. And I think it will become easier. I think like if you think about, you know, legacy radio advertising, I think it's based on a tried and tested model over the last, you know, 100 years, it's going to take a while to kind of make that work in a digital sense. I mean, Spotify obviously have the scale platform and they're going hard at that. And you could argue they're kind of owning that programmatic audio piece. But what about the rest of the podcast? It's interesting, you know, the podcast that we would listen to, the ads usually are read by the presenter. And actually, I get more you know, brand recall on that one, because I do remember the ads, because the, you know, the presenters add a bit of personality to it. Like, you know, good example being Pivot and, you know, Scott Galloway, because he seems to take the piss all the time, which just makes the ads even more interesting. But I think there's an untapped programmatic opportunity to scale a lot of this stuff. But it's interesting that the user base still remains small compared to the larger legacy radio listening population. I didn't think that was the case. And I mean, I don't know who's listening to radio. It's kind of like it's in the car or in the house. It's kind of like almost like you're not actively going to it. You kind of have it in the background, as opposed to I'm listening to a podcast and then it's my thing. And, you know, the weekend or a weekday or traveling to work or whatever. So it's an interesting one. I think that it will scale this decade for sure. Alex is right about that, because just user case and people are gravitating more towards the podcast versus the radio. But yeah, I think he's right. I think it's an untapped channel and it will grow.
Neil, what do you think?
I definitely, before I read the article, I was definitely in that kind of camp of like, oh yeah, it is kind of getting cluttered and pretty saturated. Cause like once you listen regularly to podcasts, and then you realize that you listen to two. So there's one I listen to, which is called the Jocko podcast, the Jocko Willink, the ex-Navy SEAL guy, really interesting guy, and the Jordan Peterson one. And like one will have the other one on their podcast. And once you reach that like inception of you've been on mine, I've been on yours, and like it's a podcast with a podcast, it just kind of feels a little bit weird from like a user standpoint, like a consumer. You're kind of just regurgitating and talking about the same things. And I think like it was interesting. Just to kind of round that one off, I personally think the big opportunity is for brands to like almost like self-production and trying to find a voice and trying to find their space within the podcasting space to produce content for platforms like Spotify and the such. But because the worrying thing from an advertiser standpoint is, I think it said in the article, there's a 21% year-on-year increase in subscriptions or premium subscriptions for Spotify. Obviously that's ad free, right? So like you say, like there has to be kind of like that, like yeah, read out or scripted advert read out. You know, there's another podcast I listen to called An Exchanger Talks, and that guy Zach Rogers, he does that a fair bit.
That's a rubbish podcast. An Exchanger Talks. I've listened to that. It's terrible. Obviously.
Yeah, it's absolutely atrocious. It's just so bad. But they obviously that's one where the ads are kind of read out, for example.
Yeah.
And I just think it's interesting. I think the original concept, so Spotify obviously are quite they brought in the exclusive rights to the Joe Rogan podcast, which I think is arguably one of the biggest in existence. I think the Joe Rogan podcast, they migrated over from YouTube, and then obviously they've still got the highlights on YouTube and stuff. But even that's a big commitment. It's like 3 hours. It's a 3 hour show. It's a long show.
Is it 3 hours? Is it three hours yeah, long?
Some of the episodes are 3 hours. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting that you. I think the podcast model is going to evolve, right? So the one I'm liking at the minute, right? I mean, I listen to Pivot, and I obviously listen to, you know, the Mad Tech podcast, because it's excellent, you know, it's world class. and then I listen to the All In podcast, which is quite interesting. It's a bunch of, you know, the bros from West Coast, Shamath, Jason Calacanis, David Sachs, David Freeburg, and they're all real big brains, and they're talking about, like, loads of different stuff, and it's just a free-for-all chat. Like, you know, it's like a bloody shout match in some respects, but it has energy about it. Like, so I think that the three-hour format's tough to go, right? So Axios had a really interesting format where they did 15 minutes a day in the podcast, and it was basically like drinking a cup of sugar, and it's like absolutely amazing, like just bang, bang, bang. So I think the formats need to evolve a little bit. I think you're right. There's this incestuous sort of like overlap in terms of like people ending up on other people's podcasts, and they're just chatting same shite over and over. Like, but that goes back to the conversation, Neil. Is like, you probably need to get, you know, you need to be, you know, you need, the search function for you needs to improve. Likewise, other users. You know, what do I like? You know, that, there's nothing there. You use Spotify, and Spotify push their own paid for podcasts. And Apple obviously have their own sort of algorithm, but there's no independent layer where I can go to YouTube or I can go to Google where I'd search for, you know, these are the podcasts I like, give me suggestions. I think that's a problem in the space. How do you surface brilliant content? Because it's really, really hard in some respects. And that will evolve the model. But you're right, like 3-hour podcast with Joe Rogan. I like Joe, but I think he does go on a bit much, doesn't he?
It's just, I mean, it can go from there's a Yeti in some kind of forest somewhere to jujitsu. It goes everywhere, doesn't it? It pretty much, yeah. Like the conversation is, I think as you mentioned, Grace, like the low barrier to entry is good in a way, but it's also, like you say, it doesn't do the clutter problems any favors.
Conan O'Brien as well. I just started listening to him. He's good.
Yeah.
He's very good.
I think just thinking about sort of loosely attached to the discussion about the formats, but do you think that there's a risk that podcasts could end up being sort of monopolized? Because, I mean, as you mentioned with Joe Rogan, that was acquired by Spotify, and Spotify have acquired just a spate of podcasts and podcast companies. So they acquired Megaphone, Betty Labs, Gimlet, Parcast. Do you think there's a risk that could sort of dampen the space, or might it actually help refine it and actually help with that sort of, you know, optimizing the format and improving it so that podcasts are, you know, more timely and more valuable, I suppose?
Yeah, I suppose from a platform standpoint, I think they'd be smart to do that. I think from a user standpoint, if that leads to, hey, you guys need to be innovating the format a little bit more, and you need to probably be thinking a little bit more about like what you're doing from a scripting and a talent standpoint, and what's the subjects you're covering, and, you know, how do we, like, because they're not going to want one podcast that they've got on their portfolio to almost be identical to another one. They're going to want to stoke that kind of innovation and the shift in format. So I think from a user standpoint, I think it'd be quite good. Yeah, I actually think that'd be positive.
But that's the value of having a platform like Spotify, that, you know, everybody's on it, and you can go on and they can suggest it to you. They use an algorithm to suggest it. They haven't really nailed that yet, though, have they? Like, I mean, you go on and they're not really doing that. They're not surfacing, you know, great. And I think that's what Spotify are going to end up doing. They're going to have talent, and that's a problem then for the ad industry, because then, you know, it's an ad-free zone. Like, so what is it almost like, is there like a long tail CTV type thing where like you have, you know, to buy in on all these kind of like ad funded models, and it's kind of like long to mid tail stuff like Ad Exchange or Talks, which is kind of like, you know, long tail, and, you know, Exchange Wire Mad Tech is kind of like in the Spotify zone. Like, is that what we're heading towards? I wonder.
It's a really interesting, I wasn't sure where this story could kind of take us discussion wise, but it's been very, very interesting.
It is. You start thinking about it. It sort of leads us into the next story. And I don't want to steal your thunder there, Grace, because you're world-class presenter. But it's kind of like that world, that bifurcation of streamed subscription only TV content versus the ad funded content. And where does the ad industry go from there, because you got those two worlds? Will that work? Will that be the same in the podcast world? Because it feels like that's where it's going.
Well, on that note, let's move straight into, that's a perfect segue, Kieran. Thank you very much. into our final story of the week, which is that reports have emerged that Netflix may be preparing to launch a gaming offering, with the company apparently searching for an exec to lead a gaming unit. According to a source close to the matter, the offering would take the form of a, quote, mini Apple Arcade, providing ad-free downloadable mobile games to paying subscribers. Other sources close to Netflix say that the offering will include a mixture of games from licensed Netflix intellectual property and some original titles commissioned from independent studios. The firm apparently haven't ruled out producing games in-house and even making them compatible with smart TVs. Although nothing's confirmed, the offering could go live in 2022, so next year at some point. So diving straight in, are you surprised that Netflix are moving or could be moving in this direction? Neil, what do you think?
No, not surprised at all. I think this is my favourite story. I think I could talk all day about this. This is great. I think the first place where my mind went to with this is Google Stadia. It's the natural one where you kind of look at and you think, right, who's recently tried to move into the space? Google Stadia. I think the rumored number of users that they managed to get was 2 million, and it's been live for, what, 18 months, I think, maybe.
Yeah, it's been a disaster.
Yeah, I'm not good. Like, when you think about, that's like probably like 2% of Xbox, like the Xbox kind of active user base. It's tiny what they've managed to kind of do. And obviously it's cost them a lot of money. I think even they've put their hands up and gone, yeah, we probably didn't have the expertise to be able to really nail this. So I look at that and I think Google's a tech company. Mm. Then you look at Amazon. Amazon are a marketplace, but they do have Twitch. And you would think, oh yeah, okay, maybe Twitch would probably be a good one. But again, they're a marketplace first, not an entertainment company. And I look at Netflix and I think entertainment first, everything else second. Yeah.
If there's 100%.
A company where I would have confidence in their ability to execute this well, I would say it would be Netflix. Yeah.
I love this story. This is like food and drink, red meat for the exchange wire audience. I think you're right, Neil, 100%. It's funny, I was just thinking that, like, Google's a tech business, right? It's not a media business. And Amazon kind of sits in between, right? They bought MGM, but it feels to me that Netflix will nail this. It's like, it's entertainment, right? And I was just thinking, okay, how could they get to where they need to be? Why would they not buy Epic? Epic and Netflix together would be epic.
It would be so epic.
I mean, that, like, it's very exciting because, like, Netflix just would just feel like it's entertainment, right? And you can imagine that people have been kind of pinning hopes on CTV around the gaming space, right? There's a lot of like ad funded stuff. So, like, I wrote that piece recently about the new ecosystem, and one of the areas I talked gaming would be interesting would be in the CTV space, because it just feels like a natural fit to be sitting on your couch and playing games. And I just think that Google have never really nailed a user-first product, like a physical product. Like, their phones have been a kind of a so-so success, and other bits and pieces. They never really nailed a consumer product, where I think that Netflix have that amazing relationship with their users. And if anybody could kill it, it would be Netflix. And it just makes sense that as they grow their business, and they get a lot more competition in the sort of, you know, TV content space, gaming. Like, I don't know if you noticed this, but one of the things that Netflix has been doing really well is the manga cartoons titles that they've rolled out, and they've been doing them really, really well. There's been some brilliant ones. Like, they produce some I never thought I'd be into it, but I'm watching it all the time. And it just feels that they make the natural evolution. They feel like a media tech business. They're tech, but they're media first. And this just fits into their narrative. And I could see them doing very, very well. And it's interesting you talk about Stadia. I know Apple have done a similar thing. And they've been disastrous because they can't figure out. Apple, again, is a hardware product company. It's not a media company. It doesn't seem to kind of get that business. And this could be the next growth sport for Netflix. It just solidifies their subscription business and just make, again, here we are. Where are the ads, though? Like, what is the advertisers going to do if a whole pile of gaming, as you say, Grace, casual gaming and gaming like that goes into this subscription first channel?
Yeah, I mean, do you think that Netflix could maybe potentially at some point in the future sort of steer away from that and maybe develop an ad-based option? Or, I mean, it would seem very, very out of character. But, I mean, what would be the sort of programmatic, is there any opening for them there? Or is this sort of a shut case to them?
Well, Neil's the marketer. I mean, what do you think? You think Netflix will run like, betting ads inside their programming?
Yeah, I would say so. Obviously, like Netflix has got that kind of like scale problem, right? So I think it's got to that level where the adoption of Netflix as a platform is solid, and in order to kind of take it to that next level, you're most likely going to have some kind of like ad funded model. I think for me, I think it's very delicate. I think because what makes it such a great platform is because it is ad free, because you can just one episode, next episode, next episode. I think if you were going to do it almost like the Amazon Prime way, because I think before you watch an Amazon Prime movie, it's been a while since I've had Amazon Prime, but before you watch like an Amazon Prime movie or an episode, they normally roll the ads for other Amazon Prime episodes and movies and stuff. So maybe it's kind of like, I don't know, like very short format video like that, just pre-rolls or mid-rolls in between episodes. But I think it would have to almost be like trialed very well and user tested extremely extensively in order to kind of just see like how people react to that and then what the scalability is behind it. I think that for me though, when you look at like that, like as we were just saying, like Netflix is kind of like potential real success, future success story in this world. You can just see it, like bolt on an extra £2.50 to your Netflix subscription every month. We'll ship you out a Netflix controller. There's your peripheral, or maybe one or two. Yeah. There you go. Like you play it on your... Yeah.
In that, as long as Reed Hastings is the CEO, they will never have advertising on the platform, third-party advertising. They don't need to. What they will do, I think, is product placement, like internalized product placement. They'll build their own technology where they can basically insert, you know, a Coke can or whatever into a scene virtually, or turn a particular like, you know, object in the actual film itself or program itself into a product. And that would be where they'll get their advertising revenue. But I think it would turn a lot of people off if you start putting ads into Netflix. Maybe in sort of smaller markets, they might include some sort of like pre-rolls, but I don't think Netflix need it. As you say, they've done the numbers, right? They're higher here in the gaming spaces. They, to your point, if they add another 250 onto, what's their subscriber base now? 200, 300 million more?
200, I think 203 million.
You know, yeah. Like doing the maths off the top of my head, an extra £2 a month. Even if half of them, that's 200 million, was that a year? 2.4 billion extra a year in terms of revenue. Like that's massive. Like, you know what I mean? Push that out in terms of what they get from ads and what would their sort of turn off rate be, their churn rate, if you started putting ads in Netflix. So I think the gaming thing is just a natural, I think it's brilliant. I mean, it puts more pressure on those big companies and there's another player in the space. And it means that, probably, you know, the reality is that Netflix need, you know, they're not going to spend. They'll buy back catalogs. They'll buy companies. They'll be acquiring companies. It feels like someone like Epic, who have Fortnite, would be, you know, an amazing acquisition. And you know, given the trouble that Epic had with Apple, it would just be awesome to see them on that platform. Like, so, I think the ads thing is, you know, it's again, it come down to the, like where the ads start appearing on CTV. Like, where is the content? Is it all Pluto TV? Does anybody watch Pluto TV? I watched it once.
I watched this
program called Hunter. Have you ever seen that before? It is rubbish. So it's like this 1980s cop show. It is terrible. It's so terrible, it's actually good. Wow. Highly recommend it. But it's the only show on Pluto TV I've watched. So is that where all the ads are going to be? I don't know. Is that enough for the industry?
No, I think you're right. I think I think the one that you were referencing then, I think, is the Cherry Coke in Stranger Things. That's the big example, isn't it? Like the Stranger Things example of where I think is the character, I haven't watched it, it's called Lucas, and he drinks this Cherry Coke. Yes. And it's just so obvious that it's an ad, and it's just like, but do you know what? I didn't mind it. I was like, oh, that's such an ad, but God, wow, that Cherry Coke looks good.
I think it was nostalgic though, Neil, because they were talking about the Cherry Coke's taste, and it was like, you know, when they introduced that Cherry Coke, everyone was going, what is this rubbish? And then other people liked it, you know?
Yeah, right. I think that's fine. And like trying to subtly shoehorn in the product placements. And I know obviously it's quite big for games now. Like, you know, there's companies that are obviously built to be able to monetize brands within, like, I don't know, like racing games, and you're racing past big billboards and stuff like that. But I think it was interesting over the last 12 months. I think it was AppLovin, the company who bought the company who developed Game of War. Is it MZ, the developer?
They bought Machine Zone, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, like, that's interesting, because then you start, because obviously there's the whole thing around how much money can we make, but hand in hand with that is what can we do with an incremental hour and a half on time on site or time on platform.
Exactly.
What does that look like from, like, where do we want to funnel you next, and what does it look like, the average revenue per user, what does it do to those, like, the kind of platform engagement frequency, and what does that look like? And not to add to the fact that Netflix already know how to get people to Netflix and to buy Netflix. So they'll likely already, from like a media mix standpoint, have a really good idea about how to get people to engage with this as well. So I think they're primed. I really do. I look forward to seeing this.
You're excited. I think it's a good move. It feels like, you know, I just think the Google Stadia thing is, it's not a go-to channel, is it? Like, you go into the house and you put on Netflix, and there it is. The whole thing's there. Like, but yeah, it's an interesting move. They'll do it right, I think. They'll do it right. They'll get it right.
I'm so reluctant to bring this to an end, because it's obviously both of you are so interested in it. It's such an interesting story. And I mean, there's so much we could talk about it, but alas for time limits. We'll move on to the second part of the podcast, where we'll hear a bit more from you, Neil, about what you're up to, what Sky Betting and Gaming are up to at the moment. So go ahead, give it, lay it on us.
Yeah, I'm not selling anything. It's a fresh breath there. It's just, I'm not selling anything to you. I'm just here to talk to you about a couple of different things. And one is, we'll get on to like the cookie journey, but the main thing I think that I want to kind of chat through and even get some kind of thoughts from you both on, just, you know, I joined SBG the 1st of March last year, but I was kind of obviously like in for 2 weeks before everything went a bit mad. I kind of dropped to the company, came in from MediaCom. It was an interesting transition from agency to in-house. Like, it was a really, really interesting move, from kind of moving from like that world where you're working on four or five different clients to now you're working on one, but you're in charge of a lot more, and your scope is a lot broader. And you're kind of looking after digital as kind of like a whole, or digital marketing as a whole. So yeah, it was a really interesting transition. And when I dropped into the company, we kind of didn't really have a lot in the way of reporting, measurement, creative wasn't really digital first. Data usage, we have a lot of data. We didn't really make use of a lot of any of that stuff. So, you know, we've got a wealth of first-party data. We could see these things off on the horizon, like iOS 14. Obviously, that was supposed to happen last September. Didn't happen until back in the Q1. And yeah, we've got the cookie kind of conundrum to tackle. So I think over the last year, yeah, we've been through like a bit of an evolution as a team, where we've kind of developed and deepened our partner relationships. Like, we buy everything internally, so we're in an in-house setup. We trade programmatic in-house, paid social, PPC, partnerships and everything. So we don't really rely on agencies for the kind of doing, but where we do kind of rely on them is like, say, for example, just to kind of move on to this, and the cookie deprecation is issues like this, where we're kind of almost like, you know, we've gone through that process of almost educating the leadership team around what is a cookie, taking it all the way back to basics. Like, what are cookies? What do they do? Why are they important? Like, what do we use them for at SBG? And this is the really key thing that we've kind of had to do over the last couple of months, is really quantify, like, what's the kind of quantification of the pound amount of the cookie deprecation, and what does that mean to us as a business? And then when you kind of do that, you kind of go, well, this is kind of our exposure. This is our exposure when we take away the cookie-based ability. We invest in programmatically a fair bit. And when you kind of just get rid of the kind of basis of the primary identifier that currently uses to kind of identify and target people, what's that mean for us as a business? And it makes people sit up and take notice. We've been going through that kind of process of almost banging the drum of, this is really important. We really need some kind of investment. We need some eyeballs on this. And we're kind of getting to that point now where we've evolved as a team over last year. We were a brand new team last year, a digital function. So the business had kind of reinvested in digital, found our feet, I think, at the beginning of this year, and we're ready to kind of tackle these issues. And we've just been kind of, as I mentioned, like working with our media agency, which is PhD North, to kind of just hammer out kind of like, what's our approach going to be, and what does the future look like? What should our digital transformation plan look like? And when we look at stuff like a cookie and identity crisis, we don't want to just put a band-aid over it. We want something that's future-proof, and it's going to be an amalgamation. And this is kind of where we're going, is an amalgamation of a number of different things. So it likely will be an alternative identifier that isn't based on PII, data clean room solutions, server-to-server integrations, and partnering up with different companies that are going to help us to kind of like walk that path and leveraging those relationships as best as we can. But I suppose the next step that we're kind of up to at the moment, like we've kind of just developed a framework for that. And even when I look at the calendar now, I mean, I can't believe we're in June. This year is absolutely flying by, it really is. And I even still think that we're a little bit late. Like we need to kind of get going now with revisiting a lot of the conversations with companies like LiveRamp and InfoSum and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And looking to take the conversation forward and get some test results for the back end of the year before we make a decision on who we're going to go with. It's an exciting time.
Did you, I mean, obviously you do a lot of performance stuff, right? Particularly display. How are you navigating that, like loss of the cookie window, right? Like, so, you know, you kind of optimize towards, you know, a performance metric that is dependent on that cookie window, a 30-day look back. And there's no cookie window post 2022, right? The Google have closed the door on that. So yeah. You have to do a whole new reckoning around your attribution going forward. Because like I know that, you know, you probably do a bit of brand, but like you're performance guys, you know what I mean? You're about getting people to use the app or to bet money. So how do you build for that? What's your strategy?
Well, it's a good question. So I suppose the first kind of counter to it is that SBG aren't really as performance centric as you probably would think. So I think the rest of the kind of industry and the rest of the operators, I mean, we see this quite a lot, you know, in a lot of the kind of like research and studies and industry reports that we get given by different partners and what have you. They kind of give us a view of how performance centric are you versus how mid funnel versus how brand concentrated is your advertising. And we very much live in the kind of that mid or funnel. We don't really, like, so we talk about performance display there. We don't, it's not really something that we really go after in terms of using programmatic from a performance standpoint. Quite a long time ago, probably maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the business did dabble with it. We looked at like Criteo, didn't really work. I think we started looking at programmatic as a much more, how does it come out in an econometric model? And
right.
It scores well. And we're happy to kind of make sure that we've got a diversified mix between direct buys with reputable publishers like the Reach PLCs of the world, who allow us to kind of position our advertising around premium content, and then open marketplace and PGP and pbuying as well, like just whatever kind of fits the bill. But we don't really look at display in terms of like a performance.
So you're not in the type of like the world is ending, the sky is falling down, right? So we tend to get lots of ad tech companies to go around panicking because their whole business is based on matching IDs and matching cookies. That's how they get paid. But as a brand, you kind of stand away from that. You've got your own model, your own attribution model. So even though cookies are a pain in the arse, the loss of deprecation, it's not the end or it's not disaster for your business.
No, I don't think it. I would say it's not disastrous as long as we execute the plan that we've outlined. I think that would be fine. As long as we find, you know, if it's the LiveRamp IDL, if it's like the ID5, like whatever that, or the Trade Desk ID, whatever that looks like, we want to be able to continue using programmatic in a way. I personally think, and this is actually something that came out in the presentation we did to the leadership team, we highlighted the fact that when you look at the five big programmatic spenders in the United Kingdom, I'm not going to try and guess them, but you know, there's ones that we obviously know that are on that list. And if they all of a sudden kind of go, all right, well, we don't really have as much confidence in programmatic as a channel, they're naturally going to start pushing that investment towards areas that they do see a linear return on, which is naturally going to be stuff like paid search or paid social. Walled gardens essentially end up winning. And I think as an industry, we want to, and as SPG, we don't just want to be one of those brands that kind of go, oh yeah, you know, sod it, we're just going to walk away from this, we're going to put the money elsewhere. Programmatic drives is a bit mad. Sometimes it can be quite complex, and it's always given us issues to do with identity and brand safety. I think that would be the easy way out, but I think we've really kind of taken an approach with it of, yeah, let's try and find a solution and forge one that makes sense for us as a business. And, it's cool. Like, it's a cool process to have kind of been going through. Like, we've, you know, we've, I don't think, you know, it's not often you get rid of the primary identifier that's been around since like 1994. Like, it, yeah, this is a great time for us as marketers to be able to respond to something. We got asked a question actually in our one of the leadership team sessions, and one guy was kind of like, well, when does this come to an end? Like, you know, when does this identity stuff stop being a problem? And we kind of just said it never will. Like, I don't think we're ever going to get to the time where we're okay, we're over that identity hill now. Wasn't that a fun time? And we've sorted it. I think we're probably just going to see this probably, you know, carry on, and also needing to adapt from an identity standpoint and moving away from, you know, we've got, like, after we navigate this, we've got the e-privacy regulation, which I think is being revisited in 2023. You know, that's kind of a big deal as well.
Never ends.
That's the story. I think that's the general theme. Yeah. The never-ending identity crisis.
How much has your strategy been, if at all, sort of influenced by the pandemic and everything that's happened in the past year? I mean, has it changed notably because of that, or has it sort of been able to stay the same and you've sort of just mapped it out as you originally planned?
Yeah, I think the big thing for us is brand safety. So we're definitely a brand. Like I mentioned earlier on, we're not like all kind of performance. We are much more balanced in terms of like the funnel and how we invest. But with the pandemic, and when it kind of happened, I suppose last March, and we probably were kind of really trying to find our feet in the April, May time, especially when I just kind of joined the business as well. That was a super tough time. But I think we'd had those plans of what we were going to do over Q3 and Q4. And we did have to make sure that we were, like, as a brand anyway, we do a lot of kind of suppression of people who were, like, the COVID obviously brought up a lot of things, and it was in the news. So this is no kind of secret. A lot of like gambling addiction problems and stuff like that. We suppress anybody who puts their hands up and says, you know, we want to cool off. So we work in partnership with GamStop to make sure that anyone who holds their hand up and says, hey, I don't want to play at the moment, I don't want to be hit with gambling ads, you get completely suppressed for all of our digital advertising. We don't hit anybody who is below the age of 25. We use kind of propensity model data for when people look like they're kind of getting into a state on platform. Maybe they're betting way too frequently and betting way too big, that they're added to the suppression list as well, and their accounts are frozen. So data, as I mentioned earlier on, like, for us is massive and it's key. And it when we talk about some of those brand safety elements and looking after our user base and making sure that, you know, people can gamble in games safely, it's a huge, huge deal to us. And I think that was the big priority for COVID, of not only and like negotiating and making sure that we can execute like a well thought out strategy, but it was also making sure that we're not just kind of putting in an extra, I don't know, 5 million or something to capitalize on the fact that people are at home. We've got to behave responsibly and make sure that we're becoming as a brand rather than just being an operator that doesn't really care about those kind of issues that are pretty prevalent. And obviously we've got the Gambling Act review, which is on the cards, and we need to make sure that we're working with the Gaming Council to make sure that, you know, like, users are protected. And it wouldn't have done anybody in the industry any favors if they'd have kind of just tried to hammer people during that time.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what we have time for this week. So thank you so much, Neil, for guesting and being a great guest on this episode of the podcast. It was great having you.
No, thank you very much. They say you should never meet your idols, but here I am meeting Kieron. This is it. I've been an avid listener of this podcast for some time, and of course, obviously, I listen to it more than I do Ad Exchanger Talks.
Of course, so you should listen to all the podcasts, Neil. I was only joking. Ad Exchanger Talks. fine audio production. So yeah, no, it's good to have you. Thanks.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks very much for having me. We need to catch up in New York at some point for a pint. It sounds like that's where all the action is.
Yeah, absolutely. That bar is amazing, by the way. I have to say, it was such a random, it was pictures of like boxes all over the place. Sorry, Grace, I'm just monopolizing the time as usual.
I mean, I've no comment. Thank you, Kieron.
Thank you, Grace. I thought this was a great performance, our first performance. Great. Our first duo.
Yeah.
That is brilliant. Yeah.
No, me and Grace.
I'm looking forward to the next one, Kieron. I'm counting down the days.
Me too. So I'm putting the calendar now.
Thanks again, and thank you everyone for listening.